Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I'm thrilled to have four great scholars with me tonight, people who are Mormon watchers and who are not only Mormon watchers, but at least three of them in this last little bit have given a lot of sweat and blood to actually finding out exactly where Mormonism is, especially on the issue of gender. So they really are putting their expertise and their minds to work to get a good snapshot of Mormonism as it relates to gender issues and specifically women's ordination. So I'm thrilled to have Jana Reese with us, Nancy Ross, Michael Nielsen, Stephen Marino, and Jana Reese, welcome back to Mormon Matters. You're the vet of the group as far as being on the show lots of times. You're a fan favorite, a listener favorite, and we always love you. I'll go ahead and clarify up front that of the four of you on today, you were not on the research team that prepared this survey, but I've appreciated the comments and things online that you did through your blog. Why don't you just quickly reintroduce yourself to everybody, what you do, and any comments that about what you're kind of hoping to talk about tonight.
Thank you for having me back on the show. I really enjoy talking to you and enjoy meeting your listeners when I get to see them at places like Sunstone. I was not part of the research team that created this survey. I'm just interested in it and interested in the question of women's leadership in the Mormon Church. So whatever I have to contribute is based pretty much on my opinion and not based on hard statistical fact.
You bet. Now, you tell everybody, just in case there's some first-timers that don't know the amazing Jana Reese, you're an author, you're an editor, all those good things, and tell us about your blog.
Well, I have a blog called Flunking Sainthood, which is part of Religion News Service, where I'm a senior columnist. And I've been blogging for about 5 years, which is in blog years, like dog years, I think, you know, some exponential increased number of years beyond five. It's a lot of energy to blog for 5 years. I'm also an author. I've written several books, one of which is also called Flunking Sainthood, like the blog. That was a memoir of failing at different spiritual practices. And most recently, Mormonism and American Politics, which just came out this past week.
Wow, I didn't know that. Who published that?
Columbia University Press. And I should say I was the co-editor with Randall Balmer, who was my dissertation advisor. Yes.
Super good. Hey, I'm excited to take a look at that. Oh. We might just have to have you on to talk about issues, and it would be great to get your buddy there, too.
We have such a crack team of great people. Joanna Brooks is in the book.
Oh, neat.
And Dave Campbell, lots of interesting people.
Cool. I know Randall's spoken at Mormon History Association and things, too, so great. We appreciate you being back on. Thanks, friend. Nancy Ross is our second one who's been on Mormon Matters before. You were just on maybe 2 months or something ago, Nancy, maybe
that's
less.
That's right. Just to discuss the policy change.
Right. Well, welcome back. Appreciate you. Would you tell us everything from what you do as well as maybe what your role was on the survey team?
Sure. My day job, I'm an art historian and I teach art history at Dixie State University. And I moonlight as a sociologist of religion. And so that's how I got involved in this particular project. And I was in charge of promoting the survey. And I have a great story to tell about Mormon Women's Stand.
Nice. Okay. I'm excited to hear that one. So appreciate you having you back, Nance. Michael Nielsen, you and I have been longtime friends, bit of collaborators. You were a columnist in my early days as Sunstone editor. So were you, Jana, by the way. I remember fondly both of you guys with your columns. Michael, would you tell us about yourself as well as, again, your role on the survey team?
Sure, I'm happy to. My day job is a social psychologist. I teach at Georgia Southern University. I'm also the department head there. My role in the survey was to coordinate the data collection efforts primarily. It was a big team effort, so, and we're a fairly egalitarian bunch, so coordinate is a very loose way to say it, I guess, but that's what I did in the survey.
Super. Well, it's great to have you and appreciate it, and it's fun to reconnect with you, sir.
Yes.
Stephen Marino, you and I have never met, but it's been kind of fun through our exchanges ahead of this thing to get to know you a little bit. Would you tell us about who you are, what you do, and if you want to say anything about your role on the team?
Absolutely. Yeah. I am a fourth-year assistant professor of sociology at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, deep in South Texas at the U.S.-Mexico border. My research interests revolve around the sociology of religion. I'm also a bit of a social psychologist. I'm particularly interested in how religion shapes kind of people's social environments and their reactions to their social environments. And I got involved with the project. I know a bunch of the other people kind of on and offline. I was really interested in it from the get-go. My role in the project was mostly centered on survey design, as well as the more quantitative projects using the survey data. So I'm one of the co-authors on the paper that has just been accepted for publication, and I'll be a co-author on a second quantitative paper that's kind of in the early going. So
appreciate that. All right. Good. Good to have you, and welcome to Mormon Matters.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, I want to have any of you team members, but why don't I ask Michael to start and then have any of you kind of just talk a little bit about what's the name of the group of you that got together? What was the reason for you coming together? Because you specifically wanted to, I don't know, at least nuance data that was coming out through the Pew survey and things like that when it came to female ordination within Mormonism. Would you start, Michael, and just let anybody else who wants to kick in about just what got this all going?
Well, we got started basically through Facebook. Several people were in the same Facebook group, and they were discussing the ordination or ordained women movement and the state of gender in Mormonism more broadly. And in early 2014, they decided, hey, let's actually do a study. And in many ways that came about because of stories that were coming out regarding ordained women. Those stories, when they cited data, they always tended to cite the Pew study, which found somewhere around 12% of Mormons in the U.S. being supportive of women's ordination. And that's just simply an interesting question from a social science of religion perspective, and also from the perspective of people being involved in Mormonism. At that point, all the group members except for one were LDS and very interested in it, in the question, for personal reasons or sometimes professional reasons as well. And so that's how the whole question got started. The name of the website is MormonGenderSurvey.org, and you can learn more about the group there.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And yeah, all the good information's there, including the survey itself. Steve and Nancy, add a little bit more about you. You saw these numbers from the Pew study, and was there a suspicion or something that... Well, go ahead, and I'll let you lead. I know what I'm going for, but I want you guys. There had to be some reason or other. Are we just trying to verify Pew, or are we trying to figure out something that maybe matches more what we sense is going on in the culture?
I'll just chime in. Partly it was feeling that the existing survey research on this issue was inadequate, that in a way it didn't. And this was at the heart of the paper that's just been accepted, that in a way it didn't sort of accurately reflect the way in which a policy change like that would happen. I'll also mention, in addition to the Pew data, that asks something like, would you be supportive of, you know, otherwise worthy women being ordained to the priesthood? There's another survey question from a 2006 national survey called the Faith Matters Survey, and it was published in the results from that survey, in part, were the basis for a book called American Grace, written by a couple prominent social scientists. And in that book, they briefly mention kind of Mormons' weak support for ordination, but it was a very generic survey question that asked, would you be supportive of women becoming priests or clergy at your place of worship? A question that most of us didn't think would really resonate with Mormons very much. It also found a huge gender difference, that men were much, much more supportive of it. And so this was making the rounds on the kind of Mormon internet world, and people were citing it. And myself and others thought these questions aren't, it was a small sample size too in the Faith Matters survey. We thought these questions don't really tap into the kind of a Mormon understanding of this issue. They were both small samples. So we wanted to kind of get a bigger sample and ask a question about ordination that we felt would be more reflective of how Mormons would think about the issue. So.
Super. Now, there was a line that you said, or, you know, a phrase-ish that you, I'll try to paraphrase here. And Nancy, I'd love you to pick up on it. That part of the problem with the Pew study, at least, was that it didn't reflect about how a change or a policy change like that would come about within Mormonism. And so it seemed deliberately to me, when you guys did your survey questions, that you had that in mind. Would you pick up?
That's right.
Yeah.
We were interested in some questions that reflected the culture of Mormonism, and that's how we kind of approached this particular issue, is that we wanted to understand not just the numbers, but the numbers in a more nuanced way. At the time when we formed the survey group, I was doing a lot of research with Jessica Finnegan, and so it was at least some of our conversations, and then conversations with other people who were interested in working on this, that kind of helped to bring that group, the group together. But I was also interested in doing a survey that would be effectively a kind of assessment on the effectiveness of ordained women. At the time, I was on the Ordained Women Board, and was until a little later, that I think September or so of that year. And we just wanted to see if ordained women had an effect. Any effect on the general Mormon population and what that would look like.
Yes, I caught that. Jana, I think in your blog post, I mean, you may have posted more than one. The one at least that I'm thinking of is not much had moved, right? Yes. On that. Do you want to jump in now, or we can get to that a little bit down the road, whatever you decide.
Well, and perhaps this reflects an unusual pessimism on my part. I tend to think of myself as such an optimist, but maybe that's not the case, because my headline was something like the five most depressing findings from the new survey results on priesthood. And then later that day, I saw, I think it was in the Salt Lake Tribune or somewhere, where it was much more a glass half full look, you know, yeah. Like, here's the surprise of if you turn the tables and if you ask the question differently and say that the prophet has had a revelation, then how do you feel about it? And, you know, that is a very, very different number. But I think that the depressing part about that is that it just shows that there's a large percentage of Mormons who will unthinkingly, it seems, do whatever church policy is. And suddenly that's the thing that's inspired. So it's a little bit, I felt like someone canceled Christmas. Let's just say, just looked at the results.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll get into that. So, I'm just going to go to you, Stephen, because you said that you were at least part of the actual design of the survey and what was exactly asked. And of course, everybody jump in. But what was the question? Jana kind of hinted at it, but what was it that you thought just the plain asking out of, would you support this, was one thing, but then you phrased it a different way. How did you end up phrasing it, and what were the actual results?
Yeah, I have it in front of me on my computer screen. Funny that you ask. So the way that we asked it is, let me go to the next. All right. So we replicated the Pew question that was, do you personally believe that women who are dedicated members of the church should have the opportunity to be ordained to the priesthood? And on that, our results were very, very similar to Pew's data or to the Faith Matters survey, about 10%, 10-12%. When we wanted to frame it in a way that we felt would be more reflective of how something like this would actually happen and how Mormons understand policy change like this, we asked, this is the exact wording, if the first presidency and the quorum of the 12 apostles were to receive a revelation allowing women to hold the priesthood, I would be, and response options ranged from strongly supportive to strongly opposed. And the results for that were very different, and the solid majority in both of our samples ended up being rather supportive. So,
Michael, seeing how you're another data cruncher guy, what was the differences, let's say, between men and women? And give us those actual numbers, if you would. Do you have it in front of you?
I sure don't.
Okay, well then back to Stephen, who does.
I think I
do. I have it here too, but I'd rather have you guys share it. Yeah. Okay, go for it.
Well, let me give you the exact numbers on support. And we had two samples. I don't know if we'll.
I almost stopped you before that last bit. Would you explain about that the two survey things? One was much smaller than the other, and mm-hmm. tell us how that came to be, real quick.
Go ahead, Mike.
We decided on two samples for a couple of reasons. The smaller sample was important because we wanted to try, to the best of our ability, to get a reasonably representative group of Mormons. That is, we wanted to contract with a survey company to get us a sample so that we could try to make some generalizations. Now, to do that is very expensive. And some of the team members organized a Kickstarter campaign that Jana mentioned a moment ago. And through that, we were able to raise somewhere around a little over $4,000 that went toward the expenses of that more representative survey.
And by representative, you mean age, gender, well, all that kind of different stuff, not skewing. In other words, it wasn't going to be a self-selected survey.
Exactly. Now, having said all that, I think it's really important that people understand that it's not exactly a representative survey of Mormons for several reasons. First of all, they were in the U.S. And of course, most Mormons now, according to the church's data, are outside the U.S. And then for also some real practical reasons that are basically limitations of the companies that we contracted with. They don't necessarily have a representative sample of Mormons in their group. And so when they contacted Mormons to participate in our study, what we got was a representative sample of those people, which may or may not reflect the broader LDS population. So that's one set of important limitations of the data.
And what ended up being the survey size from that Kickstarter-generated paper?
That group, we ended up with somewhere around 500 usable responses, 525, give or take.
Great. Okay, and so we'll refer that as, is it group one or survey one? I'm looking at the wrong page.
Oh, call it survey one.
Survey one, okay. So sounds good. The smaller one, survey one. The second one was probably the one that Nancy, you were helping to make sure got the word out, because it was a lot bigger and a lot more self-selected, right?
That's right. And that survey, what we wanted to do was to see, and I think in the papers we called it purpose of sampling. I would call it snowball sampling was to see that if we spread a survey out online and had people take it and share it if they chose, to see if that would come up with a population or that looked like the random sample, the more random sample that Mike just talked about. And what we discovered is that we were able to more or less recreate the population.
Awesome.
And an important part of why we had two to begin with is that the contracting out with a company to obtain responses is really expensive. And so for our $4,000, we were able to get those 500 and some odd people. We could have their time for about 15 minutes. And we had many, many more questions that would possibly fit in 15 minutes. So that's why we supplemented it with this purpose of sample. So in practical terms, that was an important consideration for us. And then in a more maybe esoteric for this audience perspective, we're also interested in this idea that some research has found that even if you start out with people who have relatively extreme views on a social issue, if you have them refer other people to take the survey, and then those people refer still other people, by the time you do that a few iterations, a few times, the responses that you get look much more like a more representative sample than those initial responses would suggest. So we were also, for technical reasons, interested in looking at that. So those are the main reasons for the two separate samples.
Thank you.
We ended up...
If I could,
go ahead, Steve.
If I could just say a couple words about these samples. The smaller sample, right, the one that we contracted, is probably closer to a national sample of Mormons. That both samples are very well educated. In the smaller sample, over half have a college degree. In the much larger purpose of sample, well over half have a college degree. Almost a quarter have a graduate degree, and they're also almost three quarters female. So it's also a very active sample. So I just wanted to point that out. These are pretty well educated and mostly female samples.
Okay, good. Okay, that's helpful. So any more about the behind the scenes, what we're going for, or should we get into results? Who has anything more from other stuff?
So the numbers for the purpose of sample were huge. You know, we had about 50,000 responses.
Right.
And I just wanted to tell a little story about how we got those.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we want it.
So yeah, you do. So, so we had a bunch of different links, and we had a certain day that we were going to release the survey on. And it was my job to kind of ask people, you know, prominent, generally progressive Mormons to take the survey and to post it on their Facebook page so that more people would take the survey, because those prominent individuals have lots of friends. And so their lots of friends would see and take the survey and then hopefully post it to their friends and generate a big sample. But we knew that even... that most of our starting points were going to be fairly progressive ones. And I knew that we needed to try and balance that out at least a little bit by having some other more conservative Mormon starting points. So one of the people I sent the link to was Mormon Women Stand, the Facebook page that are kind of anti-Mormon feminists
anti-feminists. We support the prophet people.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. More than anyone ever could. So we sent it to them and they posted it. And when they posted it, it was something like, you know, they posted the survey, and then I don't remember if it was actually in their initial posting of the survey or if it kind of came out fairly quickly, but it was something like, you know, these liberal Mormon pseudo-Mormon, you know, scholars are trying to prove these false things about what we believe. And so you faithful Mormon women need to take this survey to mess up their data and to show your stuff, kind of thing. Okay. And we really wanted them to, you know, to take the survey. And so, but that kind of made the survey controversial. And then next thing we knew, like all kinds of people, liberal and more conservative, were posting about the survey, and this taking the survey almost became an act of asserting your like kind of political position in the church, you know, and so within a couple of days we were able to get 50,000. I've done a couple of different surveys of Mormons online, and I'd only managed about 4,500 before. Mm. And I was hoping that for this survey, I remember Brent Beale being like, okay, maybe we can get 5,000. Maybe we can get 5,000, thinking, you know, maybe. And but when Mormon Women Stand posted that, and they had about 30,000 followers of their Facebook page at that time, it really went viral from there. And that was a huge help to us, yeah. Which is also funny because on a lot of the news reports, it's Catherine Skeggs, the founder of Mormon Women Stand, who doesn't really like our research at all.
Right.
But
yeah,
I have to say later. Thank you, Catherine Skeggs, because you have been tremendously helpful in this process.
Yeah, I've got Peggy's article with some quotes from her I want to bring up a little bit later. So they have 30,000 members. You don't really know what percentage of those 30,000 took it, so you don't really know if it was 30,000 from them out of your 50. But
no, but Stephen Marino might be able to speak more to that.
On who took the survey or the links that where the links were that they followed to get to
that would be helpful. Yeah, I guess that's the most direct way to get to it. Right?
We know some about that, but I don't. Mike might be able to speak to it. I know some people have looked at where people followed, you know, where the link was that they got to the survey from, but
that we have some information about that, but we've not analyzed it, but to address that kind of question takes a lot of very sophisticated analyses, because you would need to trail from one to another, sometimes maybe six times. And we've been working really with more basic questions.
Okay.
But I think it is accurate, as Stephen intimated, our responses are much more the data that we have reflects a very, on the whole, a very devout kind of perspective in terms of the percent who are temple recommend holders and those kinds of markers that we might be interested in terms of where a person stands in the church. Far and away, the great majority are very, very devout. So whether they're from Mormon Women Stands or maybe they heard about it on the news. There were news reports in the Utah area. So it could be from different places. But as a whole, they really are faithful, believing Latter-day Saints.
Cool. Great. Well, thanks for sharing that, Nance. I had kind of heard the outlines of that story before. That's very, very, very interesting. So now, there's one last thing about the survey itself that I haven't heard anybody mention, and that is in the second one, the bigger one, you also gave people a chance to write short answers about whether they felt like right now the policy on ordination as it stands, if that was cultural or doctrinal. Was that only? Yeah, tell us about that whole.
Yeah, so in the bigger survey, in the purpose of sample, we asked three open-ended questions. Do you want me to? I have the text of those in front of me.
To read the questions, and either now or later, we can at least see what you learned from that.
So the first one, the first question we asked was, and this is just reading here: men and women are treated differently in the church. Some of these differences are considered cultural; others doctrinal. Please describe these differences and why you feel they are beneficial or not beneficial. The second question follows on from that and says, if women were to serve in more administrative and leadership roles in the LDS Church, how would that affect your religious or spiritual life? Please comment in as much detail as possible. And the last question was, what changes related to women, if any, do you hope the church will implement over the next 10 or 20 years? Describe these changes in as much detail as possible. Why do you believe these changes are important?
Awesome.
Yeah, so we were able to collect quite a lot of qualitative data in addition to the more quantitative data that we collected.
What percentage of people decided to write anything at all in those sections?
So I don't know. When we have 50,000 responses, it wasn't actually possible. So I think that generated more than 3 million words of data just for these three questions. Mm-hmm. So we would need like a large team of graduate students to get anywhere like coding that. And so when we ended up writing the chapter for Voices for Equality, we did a random subset of about 500 responses.
Okay.
Because that was a much more workable sample than 50,000.
Okay. So this is already published in that book.
That's right.
Some sort of analysis of that. And I'll link to that book from the podcast page. So, okay, thanks on that. So let's kind of start talking about this, okay? Unless there's any more behind-the-scenes stuff.
No. Sure. I can pick up from sort of – I was about to describe some of the survey results in a little bit more detail.
Okay, please. Yeah, start there.
Okay. So I mentioned that when we replicated Pew's question, our findings were very, very similar, kind of in the 10% range, people that said they were supportive. But when we asked it in a way that we felt reflected the decision-making process and the sort of polity structure in the Mormon church, there was substantial support. So in sample one, about two-thirds of respondents said they would either be strongly supportive or supportive of women's ordination. In sample two, the sort of more highly educated, probably even more devout sample, it was 78% said they would support or strongly support. I think 35% said they would strongly support it. So it's remarkably different when we ask it in a way that was reflective of the way that it would actually happen.
Yes, which is through a revelation, yeah.
We have no way of knowing, whether people would actually like to see that happen.
Okay,
The Pew findings might be closer to an actual desire level, but there's an openness, that there's some sort of supportiveness of that decision, I think is remarkable, and I think was not reflected in the very little existing survey data that we had.
Of the 500 that you did the sample from, Nancy, was and one of those questions were like, what would you like to see happen? Was ordination of women pretty high among those 500?
When it came to the question of what changes do you hope to see, those changes were across the board. Definitely there were some people who mentioned ordination. I think that was a fairly small minority, but there were a lot of people. There was no consensus on what the most important change was, but a lot of people had a lot of different suggestions. And those suggestions were everything from like equalizing budgets for young men and young women to allowing women in more leadership positions, to giving the Relief Society president more powers, to making sure that women don't have to answer questions about of a sexual nature,
right.
That some of those interviews could be conducted by a relief. So that some of the closed door interviews could be either gotten rid of or done by a Relief Society presidents. And so there was no like one change that everyone mentioned. There were a lot of different changes that people mentioned. And when we get to talking more about the qualitative data, I think what happens is that people are really responding to the things that they've actually seen or experienced in their lives. And so a lot of these changes aren't just academic in nature when people were approaching these. These were often related to personal experiences.
Awesome.
And so so the variety of responses really, follows the nature of people's different experiences.
Mm, beautiful. Now, sad at heart, Jana Reese, does hearing Nancy here help you feel any better about?
No, Nancy, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Brent Beal, when I was writing with him about the blog post, he volunteered you to help me with a follow-up post on some of the qualitative data. So you have been volunteered. I don't know if you signed up for that, but thank you. Thank you.
That was at least a little help right there. There's more going on than whether or not the percentage has moved, Jana, right?
Well, no, and I think that's actually – so I was the first author on the qualitative chapter, and I would say that is the huge story from the qualitative chapter or the qualitative data is that, you know, that – we got to a lot of really interesting answers and more nuanced answers with the quantitative data, but the qualitative data reveals a very, very complex picture of how people feel about gender in Mormonism. And honestly, what we got in terms of results was nothing that I was expecting. Like,
well, tell me more about that. What were you expecting? And then what did you see?
So what I expected was, if I think about this first question, which asks people to consider the ways in which men and women are treated differently and to kind of label those as cultural or doctrinal, and then to identify those as being beneficial or not beneficial, I expected a lot more. I expected the majority of responses to say something along the lines of, yes, the way that women treated is wholly doctrinal and wholly beneficial. And the people who made that exact kind of response, they were a minority. I'm trying to look through, I've got the paper in front of me, but I want to say it was something like 20% of responses, I think it's in the neighborhood of 20% of responses looked like that.
So for that 20%, God's in charge, his message comes through clear. And if this is the way we're doing it, then that's what God really wants.
Right. But I was expecting that would be like 2/3, you know, instead of a really small number.
A fifth, yeah.
And there were some really interesting patterns that emerged. And so, first of all, I just want to say that normally when people take surveys, they skip over some of the qualitative, like open-ended response questions, because that takes more time and thought, and no one really wants to do that. But a lot of these responses had more than 100 words. These were more substantial responses. In part, I think, because people really felt they had something to prove by taking the survey, which was, you know, kind of stemmed out of the way in which the survey was presented by different people who had linked to it. Mm-hmm. But what happened is that 45% of the responses that we coded, which is kind of a subset of 500 of the 50,000, looked something like this. You know, yes, women are treated differently. Yes, it's doctrinal. Something from the some kind of statement from the proclamation, some kind of other, you know, kind of church sort of statement about gender differences between men and women. And then people will kind of go on, you know, kind of repeating church statements. And then they would get to a place and then they would say, but, you know, I saw my wife treated badly in this way, and that is cultural, and that's not beneficial. And 45% of the responses looked like this. So people started off in a very gung-ho, wholly embracing the church's position on gender, but eventually they got to a but place, because it seemed like people were thinking through this carefully. They got to a place where they were like, but, you know, I either experienced something or someone close to me experienced something and it was terrible. And that's definitely not doctrinal. And it definitely wasn't beneficial. And when those life experiences that were related after the but statement were generally, you know, it wasn't just one thing that they all these people reported. They're just a bunch of different things where they felt that either they or women close to them had been treated poorly by the church or by church leaders. And whenever people had been treated poorly, they attributed that to culture and made a clear statement that was not beneficial. And so I coded these responses, and my team coded these responses as being mixed, because in some ways, the individual is trying to align themselves with the church's position. And I think that's when we look at quantitative data where someone is kind of given a multiple choice of responses, I think you know, any good properly trained Mormon is going to know which response is the correct response. But when we ask people to think about, you know, present them with a kind of thought experiment and ask them to kind of think through their position and their experiences, what we get is messier. And I appreciate that mess. And I appreciate that people, a lot of people, detailed the messiness of their experiences with gender in the church, because a lot of people clearly wanted to show a lot of alliance with the church, but life gets in the way. And they articulated that as well in their responses. And so that really surprised me, because I didn't expect that people would relate gender messiness in the survey, or that they would articulate that. But what we got was a lot of mixed responses, a lot of, yes, some things are cultural and some things are doctrinal and some things are beneficial and some things are not beneficial, all in these individual responses.
Wow, that's great. Now, Jana, I want you to respond to her, but in some ways it almost sounds like in writing these things, you posed a question in such a way that people may have actually begun almost for the first time to ask themselves these questions.
And I think that's
yeah,
possible.
So it's like you guys did a service. It'd be interesting to resurvey those people to see if there was any changes just from that little, I do have a butt in here, you know, or something. Yeah, but anyway, fun. Jan, I want to give you a chance to say whatever you want in response to kind of hearing what Nancy just shared.
I think my reaction to the qualitative is a hopeful reaction. And I'm really interested to see when you drill down how people respond to some of these questions, because anecdotally, which is the only thing I have to contribute to this conversation, right, is my anecdotal experience. Even the most conservative Mormons I know are sensitive to issues of sexism when they see it with their daughters, when it's overt, when it is cultural and, as you say, not doctrinal, and they can kind of make that distinction in their minds. They might not call it sexism, but many of them are aware, particularly when it's, you know, young people that they love who are experiencing this. So I'll be very curious to see what those results are from the qualitative data.
Super. And that's kind of my experience too, because and that's partly why I asked the questions early on, you know, when you were getting the raw data from Pew and things like that. I think so many of us who have actually talked with people, you can guess that, you know, yeah, of course, number one for them, just because that's where they are in their faith journeys or, you know, whatever it is. They haven't wrestled with questions before, but you know that with two or three questions or, you know, give them some moments and things like that, that they would be able to admit, you know, problems with the church, of course, not the gospel, you know, that famous little separation. But I love that. I want to get...
Can I just jump in?
Please.
Quick comment there. And I agree. I think people would point that out, but sometimes what people indicate is that, oh, well, that's just a one-off thing. You know, that bad thing that happened, that was like an accident, or that was just this one person. And that none of these things actually reflect any larger problem with the church or church culture. And I think kind of what the surveys show is that there absolutely are systemic problems.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And we should label that, you know.
This is Michael. I just wanted to pick up on what Nancy said, because that was in the qualitative responses I've seen, that's very much a theme, is that when something that seems negative happens, it's often attributed to an idiosyncrasy in terms of leadership, that this person, he made a mistake, he interpreted a policy incorrectly, something like that, so that it's recognized by the individual as being a problem with another individual, not with the institution. And I think one reason for that might be that it's easier for the individual to reconcile if that's the case. The leader is human.
Right.
It's that person. It's not this institution that I identify with so closely.
Awesome. Now, Nancy, let me follow up on that, because you said it shows that it's systemic, but you're saying basically it shows it's systemic because so many people have the one experience, or were there enough responses that you could tell that the people who were sharing also thought it was systemic?
So there were definitely some people who kind of said that, So there are definitely some people who responded to the survey who said that all the ways in which men and women were treated differently were in fact cultural and not doctrinal and definitely not beneficial. So that was a significant group as well. I think that group was actually slightly larger than the group who said, no, it's all doctrinal and it's all beneficial. And so those people knew that it was systemic and understood that that it wasn't just a one-off. But the people who were in this mixed group, like, yes, some of this is cultural and some of the way in which women are treated is doctrinal, and sometimes it's beneficial and sometimes it's not beneficial, with things that are doctrinal always being beneficial and things that are cultural being not beneficial, that those people did not seem aware. And some of them periodically tried to emphasize, you know, like, but that was just a one-off thing. Because I think that people are very protective of the church and church leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent. This is really quite interesting and rich area. Now, one question that also occurred to me, was there anybody who said it is cultural and it's beneficial? Because you said there's lots of people who says it's doctrinal and it's beneficial. Did you have very many people that says this little craziness is beneficial as well?
I think we may have had a few, but I don't think that they formed a substantial group.
That'd be my guess too. Good. All right. Thank you. Hey. Yes, please jump in.
The results, the quantitative data kind of speak to some of these same issues. And I was hoping to. So the whole point of the paper that has recently been accepted for publication is to not only sort of look at the basic kind of results in terms of support for ordination for either survey question, but to look at predictors of who would be supportive of ordination for either question, for our, you know, the replication of the pew or this question that we felt was more reflective of how change would work. And we found that, like some other surveys have found, we found that men were slightly more supportive than women. And if you want to talk about that later, we can talk about it.
You know, it could be a fun conversation.
It's not a huge difference. It's really not a big difference, but it's there. We found that, interestingly, on the pew question, the sort of the more active in the church the respondent, the less supportive they were of ordination, which is not surprising. We found for the other question, the more highly active in the church the respondent, the more supportive they were of, that they would support ordination of women if it was an announcement by the First Presidency.
Which is more about their belief in the prophet and First Presidency.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It has little, We found that we asked a question about whether people believe the sort of different gender roles in the church were sort of cultural in nature, doctrinal, or some mix. And we found that pretty consistently, and all of this stuff is sort of, controlling for age and gender and political orientation. We found that those people that believed that those differences were mostly cultural in nature were more supportive on both survey questions of a female ordination. And then you guys were talking about sort of personal experiences, that people felt they've been treated in, treated unfairly. Sort of by far and away, the strongest predictor was what we called this perceptions of gender inequality scale. So we asked 8 questions that sort of tapped into, whether or not people believed that sort of gender differences in the church or the roles given to men and women in the church are fair, or whether they're sort of, divinely ordained. Questions here. So here's some example. God has established different roles for men and women. The way women are treated in the church is a problem. If women were given more leadership responsibilities, it would strengthen the church. and so on. Oh, it's not fair that 12-year-old boys can pass the sacrament, but 12-year-old girls cannot. And there were a few others. And so we asked the extent to which people agreed with these statements, and then we sort of formed a single scale out of that. And we found that that sort of by far and away was the strongest predictor. So people who scored higher on this scale, much more supportive on both ordination questions, much more supportive of female ordination.
Now that's really helpful to me, because I didn't spot that, at least in what I've read so far. I thought I at least looked at the main, you know, paper PDF that you guys, you know, have done. Yeah. So is this something coming forth soon, or?
Yeah, that was I don't think in the report that we created, I don't think that got a lot of treatment, but it's kind of a focal point in the paper that's recently been accepted at Mental Health, Religion, and Culture.
Okay, thank you. That's great. No, that's super interesting.
The paper that is online, the report rather, that deals more with simpler variables, simpler analyses.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
The paper that Stephen's talking about is much more sophisticated and things that would be harder to translate into everyday people's understandings.
Yeah, but talking about it helps. So I think what you just did right there to tell us how you created that scale and all that stuff, Stephen, was very helpful. So thank you very much. I'm excited. This is really quite interesting and far more nuanced, like I say, than just that report. So I'm really excited about it. What else finding wise would you guys like to talk about? And then I just kind of want to move us more into, okay, now we kind of have a sense of where we are. You know, what's ahead for us, or what would we hope, and those kinds of things. And then I have also just one more question about that Mormon Women Stand stuff. But anything more finding wise that you want to at least put out there?
Well, the main thing I would add is that we have, as you can imagine, we just have a lot of data, and we're still in the process of analyzing it. We have several papers planned out, and we're just trying to take them one at a time. The research we've done thus far, the analyses, Stephen's done a great job hitting the highlights, Nancy on the qualitative.
Awesome. Well, and the report, everyone who does click to it through the website or whatever, it does talk about these future papers and more analysis coming and stuff like that. So I'm thrilled on all that. All right. So let me ask my Mormon Women Stand question first, and then I want to kind of go, okay, here's where we are now. What do we want to do next? That kind of thing. The Catherine Skaggs quotes, and she again was the founder of Mormon Women Stand, from Peggy Fletcher Stack's article in the Tribune, showed to me a really interesting person. I guess I'm just trying to get a feel for this mindset, because it was more like this was an unfair survey. If I would have known, or if more of the women in my group and my affiliation cohorts, if we would have known that these guys would be using it in these abusive, that you're basically abusing the data, you were very cunning by posing the question this way, and if we knew this was going to be this way, we wouldn't have participated, because now we're pawns in your big, you know, master plot to change the church. What's behind her kind of comment there? And do you guys see it more about Mormon women's ordination, or is it more simply about, we don't like feminist voices, you know, and the prominence that they're starting to gain within Mormonism? I'll start with you, Nance.
I kind of hear fear in her voice, like in that comment. I think fear of being associated with the survey. I think Mormon Women Stand tries to be, you know, 100% for whatever the church says all the time. And I think that maybe the fact that they played a role in this is unnerving to her. And they see any kind of exposition or academic work as kind of a threat to cultural norms. I mean, I think that that's how I would put it. And they want to let the church set all the cultural norms and to be, and for all those things to be good, whatever the church decides. And I think it's very difficult for them to see outside analysis because that's threatening.
So that's interesting on the cultural norms as also divine. That's just, so in some ways you did, without saying it, you kind of agree with me. It wasn't so much about this particular question as much as we like the status quo. It's not so much that we wouldn't know what to do with ourselves if all of a sudden we had priesthood or we were in more administrative roles.
Perhaps, you know, I don't want to put words into her mouth, but I do hear fear in her comments. That fear of change, fear of not being seen as loyal to the church as they would like, as she would like to be, and just fear of intellectual analysis, as somehow, which she may perceive as being somehow antithetical to faith and the gospel.
Okay. So it's almost like personal conspicuousness that we were part of this rather than, because what I guess I'm trying to get at, and maybe I'll just have to throw this to Jana. Jana, can you enter into the mindset at all of priesthood and more administrative stuff in Mormonism is a terrible idea, you know, versus one of, you know, like what Nancy was kind of emphasizing. This is the prophet and the God speaks and the way things are the way that things are. And we support it and we don't want to look like we're not supporting it. Is there anything in the mindset itself of, boy, priesthood would be a terrible thing? This is a game.
You're asking me to play devil's advocate, I think, and I will try.
Thank you for trying.
Yes, absolutely. So what I hear from women who do not want the priesthood are several different things. And, you know, one of them is the refrain, I already have plenty of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I don't need any more. I don't want any more. My own feeling about that is that it's a very understandable reaction. But as Nancy said, there are some systemic issues in the church and frankly in culture more generally that contribute to women's exhaustion. So maybe we should think about addressing those. We could also think about sharing the load with priesthood. Priesthood would be a huge responsibility for women to take on if it were defined as it is currently defined. You know, with these men going to meetings from 7 in the morning until sometimes 8 p.m. on Sundays. That's not appropriate for both parents to be doing. So let's talk about how the whole system is working or not working rather than just women being exhausted. Okay, so that's the first one, women who say they don't want additional responsibility. The second is, frankly, more troubling to me. The exhaustion, I can understand. I don't think it's a particularly Mormon approach to ever say, I'm too tired to do this. We are very, you know, hyperactive people. But the second one is more troubling to me on a doctrinal level, which is that men need the priesthood essentially because they are babies. And if they don't have the priesthood, they will all stop coming to church, etc. I mean, I'm sure you've heard something like that, right?
Yes.
And I find that very disturbing in that it is, you know, it's so damaging to men to be regarded in this way that they cannot be grown-ups without being allowed exclusive access to this particular sandbox. And that is a very sad commentary about how we view women and men in our culture. But I don't think that that's an insurmountable obstacle with priesthood. So those are a couple of things that I hear. I'm interested to find out what you all women say.
I would also just jump in and say that both the things you mentioned, Jana, the idea that men need the priesthood for whatever reason, where women don't have that same need, and that women in expanded leadership roles, it would just be too exhausting because women have too much to do. That theme that specifically appeared many times throughout the survey when we asked people to consider expanded leadership roles for women.
Mm. And what were some of the things that they would say?
Just that women, you know, especially from women themselves, and I don't have an example of a response to hand, but they would just say something like, you know, I do my visiting teaching. I have four young children. I, you know, I have this calling or I have that calling, and I do so much for the church. I couldn't do any more.
Mm-hmm.
And so they feel, I think, overwhelmed with existing responsibilities and the idea of taking on priesthood, which you see is this monumental other thing, would be far more than they feel that, for some women anyway, that they feel that they could really cope with. Especially when it comes to things like meetings, because we have such a strong meeting culture.
Right. Now, is there, you know, in all those answers, Jana, you're one and you're two, and Nancy, what you just said, no one, it seems like in those particular discussions are saying, but what about voice in actual decision making? I'm not hearing anything about voice. Do you sense, Nance, from either the qualitative stuff or just in general, both of you, or the guys jump in too, to me, that's almost the key issue, is I want to be there when things that affect me are, you know, or affect all of us are doing it. Or I know that women see the world so differently and, you know, our experiences so differently. How on earth could we ever expect that we're having inspired decision making when we're not even, you know, in the room? So those to me are the bigger issues. And yet I didn't hear anything there yet.
Sure. And I think I can speak to that. I don't have necessarily numbers, percentages of qualitative responses that mention that. But there is certainly a lot of that that came up in these responses, which is that women want to feel represented to church leadership on every level, and that some women do not feel that their male leaders do that, or that they're kind of able to fill that role of understanding their needs. And so that issue came up as well. I mean, many women expressed not necessarily the idea to be leaders themselves, but to have women as leaders that they could go to as women, and that there would be more of a common bond and understanding there. The same way that it does often seem that men in the church sometimes seem to have kind of a common bond, but that women want that as well with their leaders.
Thank mm-hmm. you. Jana, do you have anything in my voice question or representation question?
I actually feel far more optimistic about the voice question than I do about the priesthood situation. You know, I am in favor of female ordination, and in part I know that that's because of my background personally and because I trained to be a pastor. You know, I went to divinity school for 3 years and I practiced, you know, baptizing little dolls and whatever. You practice all of those things and the real stuff, like going to visit people in the hospital and praying with them. And you can't have an experience like that and not understand the tremendous growth that can happen when you are stretching yourself spiritually, when you are exercising these gifts that you may not have even known that you had. And so one of this is all a lead up to say that probably a third argument that I hear again and again is, I already have access to the priesthood. I have all the priesthood I need. I have all the blessings of the priesthood. Why would I want to hold the priesthood and exercise it? And to which I respond, that's how we grow. Mormonism is about growth. It is about progress. And I feel like I'm not being stretched spiritually. I have plenty to do. I have lots of jobs to do at church, but very few of them, frankly, utilize some of the gifts that I was trained to use. And so priesthood to me is an opportunity lost. It's an opportunity that I might have had to continue stretching myself. And, you know, I've just had to do that in other ways and to supplement by doing things outside the church that help to develop those gifts. And that's been very nourishing and beautiful for me. So your question about leadership and visibility, I think, is an interesting one. You know, Nylan McBain has done some wonderful work in this middle situation, this middle ground. She is not a supporter of women's ordination, but she's looking around and saying, what can we do to change this culture? What can we do to change people's experience at church so that women feel heard, so that they are part of the decision making and they are represented in these choices that are being made? And her work is having an impact. I think it is making a difference. I know that there are a lot of Mormons who are liberal, and I certainly count myself in that group, but people who have dismissed that middle ground in a way that I find is sad. You know, I find that to be sad, because there are going to be plenty of Mormons who are not supportive of women's ordination, but who could say, yes, I think that women should be more involved, and I think that there's no reason why a woman couldn't be the local Sunday school president. There's no reason that a woman couldn't be a clerk. If she is, you know, an attorney in her life and she's dealing with tax law, why the heck could she not be a clerk in the church? And asking those kinds of questions.
Yeah. Thank you. And I'm glad you brought up Nylon as this, like you say, occupying that middle space and doing that. And in some ways, I've support Nylon too, because it's almost to me more like you don't know what you're missing until you see it, or until you know it gets fed to you or something. And this higher visibility will naturally show. And you talked about different gifts that you were trained to in the pastorship, but just people naturally have, some have leadership gifts, others have healing gifts and things like this. And in those ways, those would naturally rise up, and I think it would feel less threatening when you saw them, even if it weren't for this big trip thing of ordination. So that's at least where Nylon's work fits for me. I'm ultimately with you, Jana, in that I think ordination needs to happen, but I recognize the center of the church is not shifted enough for that.
Can I just add one more thing, which is the question of theological paradigm that surrounds women's ordination. When I hear liberal Mormons say anything short of women's ordination is crap, you know, anything short of full equality is crap. Well, they're operating under the same paradigm that says the prophet has to be zapped miraculously by God with a revelation out of nowhere in order for this to happen, whereas in reality, the way it happens is these small changes lead up to the enormous change that will eventually happen, and it all makes a difference.
I agree. Thank you. Anybody else jump in at this point on, you know, this, what's going on in people's brains, and what do you think might continue to lead to the most shifts?
A couple of things. One is, I don't know about Mormon Women Stand or them as a group or as individuals. I do know that many people object to the social scientific study of religion in general. It comes, as Nancy suggested, comes out of a sense of fear or concern that it somehow contaminates this very wondrous and important part of life. And so they just object to research in general. And that might be part of what's going on with objections to the study. The way I try to understand it, though, is through something called system justification theory. This hasn't really been applied to Mormon women, but it's how I've been thinking about these kinds of objections. And it starts with the idea that we have belief systems because we want to make sense of the world, and we want to have a sense of place in the world and to feel like things are fair, that they're the way they should be, at least, if not exactly fair. And when we have this as part of our belief system, it gives us an ability to cope with our situation, even if it's unfair, or even if it's by some criterion not equal to someone else. It's how the universe, it's how God wants it to be. It's how it should be in some sense. And if I'm in that situation, then I can actually benefit from that in certain ways. I can feel a sense of stability, predictability in what's coming in my life. It gives me meaning in my status, my place in society and in the institutions is where I should be. And in doing that, it can give me a sense of control. And that helps me cope with stress. It helps me respond to the things that come up in life that challenge me. And it gives me a belief system that can help me push through and make it through those tough times in life. And research finds that that is a very common way that people in a lower status group cope with their lower status. It's actually part of their coping mechanism. And when you tie that to religion, you get the added benefit that usually if the individual perseveres and hangs in there, then in the eternities, things will be made right.
Right.
And that hope of eternal promise is really helpful to the person in that situation. So that's how I've been trying to think of it.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if it's a challenge so much as the term lower status. In this case, were you referring purely to women who have a lower status in the sense that they're not in the administrative councils, or were you just talking about people in general who maybe aren't as educated, there's just some danger in that wording. Do you want to address that a little more thoroughly?
The lower status, that I'm taking from research other people have done. I'm not necessarily saying women have lower status, although if you look in purely institutional markers in Mormonism, if you divide up women and men separately, you see very distinct differences in their status in the hierarchy.
Yes. Okay.
A woman is not going to be permanently in charge of the Relief Society. It's a limited term appointment, just as one example.
Good. Okay. So that definitely, yeah. There, if we take the emotion out of the term lower status, then I can see that fitting. So maybe it works in social studies, social sciences, but not so much in everyday conversation.
I don't mean to imply
we're all so PC here. Right. You know, here's Weatherspoon throwing the PC, and I know that'll drive some people there. But thanks on that, because I didn't want it to imply, you know, because for me, I'm alerted to stages of development. I don't like the hierarchical nature that some really respond to in that and stuff. So I appreciate
that. I'm just talking purely in social science kinds of terms. And actually, in a way, you could even see a not so much system justification theory, but the general objection to doing social science of religion. You could see that a bit in the Deseret News' headline for the article where they discussed the study. I don't have it in front of me. It said something like, flawed study shows church members support continuing revelation. That was the gist of the headline. And so that's very consistent with the general mindset that we shouldn't study this, but hey, we found something that's consistent with our world, with our understanding. So we'll incorporate that because it's internal, it's consistent with our internal belief system. We'll disregard the part that may not quite be so consistent.
Fascinating. I had no clue about that headline. You're right. That is just like a perfect fit for that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. Stephen, do you want to jump in with any just general thoughts in this, basically where we are?
Yeah, sure. I was just going to chime in. Something that I hinted to in the emails we were exchanging, just kind of an early preliminary finding for some of the other quantitative analysis that we've done. Of course, on the survey, we asked female respondents, you know, whether they would be interested in being ordained if the policy were changed. And we presented these findings at a national conference. We had a session. We presented a whole series of presentations. But we presented some sort of early findings from that particular question and predictors of which Mormon women would want to be ordained. And there weren't a lot of predictors except for education, which was by far and away the strongest predictor. So particularly really, really highly educated women expressed the most support for being ordained, and probably for some of the reasons that you all have been talking about. People that feel that they have talents to share, and they've also experienced sort of success and had their talents and their contributions valued in other dimensions of their lives.
Yeah, they're used to being heard. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to kind of put that in there, that that looks like that paper that, you know, and maybe not surprisingly, but that's the really the main, that's the main predictor.
Yes. So. Well, good. Thank you for that. That probably is something I should have said very early on. We're doing this podcast with this group, and we kind of divided it up, sort of things to cover and not to cover between a group that John DeLynn is putting together for Mormon Stories. So he's probably, recording about the same time we are. So by Monday or Tuesday, there'll be both a Mormon Stories and a Mormon Matters releases on this. And one of the things that was going to go into more detail there was what you just talked about, Stephen. So thank you for that. And it'll be different panelists in the two groups. Hey, you guys, thank you so much. This is about the length of time that we wanted to have this call go. So let me just close with this and frame it to you as a way to do your closing remarks, and feel free to say other things as well. But, there are reasons for hope, and there's reasons for, there's more to be done. And I would love each of you, if you can come up with one that gives you the most hope, either from the survey results or just your sense of where we are in gender, on gender issues within the church, gender relations between men and women, whatever it might be. So your best thing of hope, and that one area that, boy, we're not going to make progress unless we really buckle down and find a way through on this one. So if I can give you guys that as a closing challenge, I will. Stephen, I know you're having the most technical difficulties, so we'll throw to you first if that's all right.
Yeah. The thing that is exciting for me is that it's getting attention, that we had a huge response for our survey, that our results are getting published, that media outlets are taking notice, that people are talking about it. And when things get talked about, and when issues are raised, then hopefully we can make progress. So that's the thing, as a, from my perspective, that's exciting.
Thank you. How about, is there any, like, of the particular set of problems, what strikes you as the hardest to tackle?
That even sort of the perception that there could be another way. I think that it's still, it's relatively few Mormons are sort of really thinking and talking about these issues, how to sort of, make the church a place where men and women's contributions are sort of more equal and, valued the same. I think just that there's still a long ways to go in terms of how people even perceive this stuff.
Yes. Good stuff. Hey, thanks for being on, brother.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Michael, let's go to you next. We'll let the women bring it home here at the end. What would your top and your bottom be as far as hope and buckle down?
What gives me hope, I guess, is the fact that we have an open canon that explicitly allows for change, as it provides a mechanism for change.
And the survey results tell us that if the change was made, people would follow along.
Right. We've seen changes happen in other areas of life where, even where leaders of the church have said this will never change, we saw a change in polygamy, at least in terms of how it's dealt with on earth. We've also more recently seen changes in how general authorities have talked about women's roles in the temple, for example, and suggest talking about women essentially having priesthood but not being ordained to an office in the priesthood. I've been in the church now, 50-some years, and when I was growing up, I never heard language like that, but I'm hearing it now. So I think those are reasons why there might be some reason to be optimistic. And the number of people who are affected. Women are more likely to be in attendance than men are across the board in Christianity. Mormonism's the same that way. And so there's a real population who have the potential to be affected. So those are reasons why I would be a bit optimistic, I guess.
Super. You want to go the other direction?
No, but I will.
I want, but Now, this is an authoritative person here saying you must.
So on the other side of the coin, I think that as long as there are religions that are that carry a very distinct segregation or separation in gender roles, so as long as Catholicism doesn't allow women to be ordained, as long as in Islam, Muslim women are not imams, and as long as Reform Judaism is more of a fringe, I don't mean that any disrespect to my Jewish friends, but a Reform orientation toward Judaism is not the mainstream understanding of Judaism. As long as religions maintain that more conservative gender role separation, that gives Mormonism a way to preserve gender roles and to say that it's doing so in order to exercise its religious liberty rights.
That is very insightful. Thank you very much. Michael, thanks for being on.
My pleasure.
It's
thanks.
Fun to reconnect with you, sir.
Absolutely.
I'm going to out you as one of my faithful donors, too, and I really, really appreciate that. I hope you hear from me often enough about how much that helps.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you. Nancy, what he just said about other religions reminded me of an angle that you took on our podcast about the policy change about LGBT.
Right.
And I don't mean to feed this as your hope or your other one, but do you want to riff for a minute a little bit about that whole idea of Mormons are watching other conservative traditions and perhaps, planning accordingly?
Yeah, there's some research by Mark Chavez. I think he's from Notre Dame, and he wrote a book called Ordaining Women, which followed the different Christian denominations and who ordained women and tried to, look at that closely. And one thing that he discussed was this idea that churches band together on certain causes, maybe it's charity work or political issues, and they often band together based on their alignment on certain issues, and that women, the role of women is one of these important issues where churches signal to each other, often through something like ordination, where they stand on the issue of modernization, so that women's issues in Christianity serve as a proxy for larger issues of modernization in Christianity in America today. And churches tend to band together with other churches that have similar positions. And so we, as Mormons, would align ourselves with like Catholics and evangelicals. And so I think that what Mike has to say is true. Like if we did see a significant shift, in the possibility of the ordination of women in Catholicism, like I think that would have a knock-on effect in Mormonism. It wouldn't be felt immediately, but in terms of, if these are the churches that Mormonism associates itself with and they begin to make changes, then there is more space for Mormonism to make for Mormons to make change as well. I think for myself, I feel like something that gives me hope is in this qualitative data where people feel like people do see problems, even if they see many issues as being individual rather than systemic. And that gives me a lot of hope that if we encourage people to see that, if we open people's eyes, then they may begin to see that some of these problems are systemic and that there are real issues that do need addressing. And that gave me a lot of hope. When I did this research, it was just such a big surprise to me, and it did feel very hopeful. I think one thing that would have to change in the church to be able to begin to make progress is for women's spiritual gifts, including women's authority, to be recognized, because I just don't think that we really truly recognize women as having authority in Mormonism. And for that to change, we have to respect the decisions, the inspiration, the revelation that women receive, and not just the inspiration and revelation that men receive.
Yeah. there's that amorphous thing in there that somehow, because you have priesthood, because hands are placed on your head, somehow you, you know, just it's somehow or other your insights are better. You know, I've never quite
or more authoritative.
Yeah, well, definitely that. Yeah, so I don't never yeah. how quite that always works, but it surprises me that somehow or other something like quasi magical happens with priesthood.
Right.
You just don't get things wrong. You know,
Or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Nance. It was wonderful to have
thank you.
And thank you, especially for sharing so much of the richness of this. And I just, God, I'm so excited to hear of that 45% of them that started out one way and kind of, oh, by the way. That was fantastic. So thank you very
thank
much
you.
For being on. Jana, I've brought you on, and I hope you didn't feel like you're playing the role of, oh, I'm sad, and now Dan's trying to make me happy, and all this kind of stuff. But thank you just for being on, and let us riff a little bit, if you would, on your two ways to go.
Well, I find this a very encouraging conversation. When I was reading the results, essentially by myself, and then groaning inwardly, because I did think that the numbers would be higher after all of the attention that has been given in the last, you know, 3 years since the findings were, I think, in the 2011 survey. Nancy would have to let me know that. But
That's right.
Okay, so we've had huge conversations and international news. I was in Turkey when Kate Kelly was excommunicated, and I heard about it. You know, this was international news. And for there to be so little movement in the first question, the responses to the first question, I found to be very disturbing and sad. However, there is definitely reason to hope here, not only in the way that Mormons responded when asked the question differently, if the prophet had received this revelation, this is how I would feel, but also, as Nancy put it, in the qualitative data, that there is nuance here. There is some gray area in which people are thinking, they're engaging these questions. And so I would say there's progress there. That's a very optimistic thing to me. And also that we have seen incremental change within the church in women's visibility just in the last few years. They are small changes, but they're important changes. And I find that encouraging. As far as what obstacle remains and what would need to change, I think that, you know, you can't be what you can't see. That's the issue always in Mormonism. You know, you can't understand how to exercise spiritual gifts as a woman if you don't know the history of women doing that, and you certainly don't see it in Relief Society today, women blessing each other, women laying hands on each other. Nothing like that, of course, happens, unless it's by accident, right, in Relief Society. And so that would have to change. There would have to be examples. And I'm not quite sure what that would look like, but it's fascinating to think about. Also, I'm glad that somebody brought up the issue of Catholicism. We tend to, in the Mormon world, we're very insular. Not just conservative Mormons are insular in that believing Mormonism has the only truth, right? Liberal Mormons are very insular as well in thinking that we have the only problems. And I would say that another very influential survey that was done this year, another Pew survey of Roman Catholics in preparation for the Pope's visit this fall, this summer, Pew did a very interesting study of Catholic views on all kinds of issues, including women priests. That was one of the questions. And 59% of Roman Catholics who were active Roman Catholics and still self-identify as Catholics said that they wanted women to be priests. For cultural Catholics, it was much higher. I think it was 77%. And that's instructive in that it's still a tradition that does not ordain women, but at least in the United States, which is not Roman Catholicism globally, but at least here in the United States, it's now a majority of both, you know, if you take both of those groups together, of Catholics who would like to see women be priests. That's very interesting to me. And I think Nancy's right, that it does spill over. We don't live in a vacuum.
Super. Anything else?
No, I think that I've probably taken up too much of your time.
Not even. Jana, thank you. Always love having you on here. And
thank you so much. It was fun.
Mormon Matters listeners, thank you for tuning in again. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Please come to the MormonMatters.org website under the comments section. Share questions, share your own reflections, your own sense of what's going on, the things that you think were the most hopeful signs for where we are at this time. Consider this survey a snapshot of where we are, as well as what it is that you think will have to change the most before we might see movement a little bit least more towards the actual ordination of women, if that's the goal. And I know not everybody agrees with that as a goal, so that's just fine too. But we're grateful for you. Thank you as you come to the website and happen to notice the donate button or the subscribe button. It's so wonderful when you click on that and go, you know, in there and donate something. This is the end of the year and lots of things are calling for your attention. But if you want that extra little tax deductible donation, Mormon Matters would gladly receive it. It's such a blessing to me to be able to make most of my living from this and to be able to have the time not only to produce it as often as you do, but also just to have all the conversations that this generates through correspondence that I have with many of you. I just really appreciate having this chance, and you guys are the ones that make it possible. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Panelists, thank you one more time for being with us. You are all amazing. Thank you, thank you, and good night.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Let's close with the usual. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.